lectures in honor of probably the 20th century's greatest urbanist. And they're meant to bring to the LSC people who are either involved in the real world, and I don't put quotation marks around that phrase, or people who are doing the kinds of scholarly work that we might not normally encounter at the LSC. And just before I introduce Gabriel Ternaturi, I'd like to thank Sarah Ichioka, who has administered the Jane Jacobs lectures this year brilliantly, and we're all very grateful to her. Gabriela Ternaturi is the kind of platonic essence of a Jane Jacobs lecturer. She is somebody who writes about cities not as an urbanist, not technically, but who writes about the culture of cities. I hope I don't embarrass her by saying that she's one of Italy's leading culture critics. She writes for many Italian newspapers. Her work has been translated in many foreign languages and is just beginning to appear in English. She's written a book on betrayal. Is that how you translate it in English? Yeah. Yeah, betrayal, which will appear in English, and a book on sociology and literature, which will shortly appear in English. Her interest in cities stems from her interest in Georg Simmel, initially, and she is a leading analyst of Simmel's work. Tonight, what she's going to talk about is the and I should say that she is professor of sociology and of the sociology of culture at the University of Bologna. Tonight she is going to talk about the cultural images of the city from Simmel to Italo Calvino. And what we have arranged is that she'll talk for about 45 or 50 minutes, and we invite, you know, as usual, invite you to pose questions. If the questions are not quite clear in English, Richard Burdett, the former director of the Cities program, who is also multilingual in Italian, will help you out. So it's a really great honor to invite Gabriel Ternaturi to come to the LSC and to give this final Jane Jacobs lecture. Thank you.
I thank you, the London School, for inviting me. And I find this occasion a very interesting occasion for me to talk about a new work that I am writing, that is a work on literature and cities. Actually, I should have named this lecture as two discourses on cities, the sociological one and the literature one. But the reference are primarily to Georg Simmel and Italo Calvino, anyway. First of all, what I mean for a cultural perspective. A cultural perspective of metropolises perceives them as a social order produced through specific social processes and relationships. At the core of a cultural perspective on cities stands the analysis of a particular subjectivity coming into being by means of experiences and interactions that are typically metropolitan. This kind of reading finds its first theoretical setting in Georg Simmel, who entitled his work The Metropolis and Mental Life. He was followed on this path by some sociologists at the Chicago School, and also by many, many novelists, attentive observers and reporters of the metropolitan experience. Consequently, since the very beginning of the existence of metropolises, the dialogue between researchers and writers on metropolitan life intermingled. I intend addressing this very dialogue. There is a very important factor, however, that links the two discourses, the literary one and the sociological one, and which I am very keen about. Such discourses examine the city and the metropolis as a temporal flows rather than spatial dimension. They deal with the city as a processuality. I shall try and demonstrate how this approach, overturning the dominant approach that is purely spatial and topographic, is present in Zimmel, Jane Jacobs, and a few other sociologists, and especially in almost all metropolitan novelists, and especially in Calvino. For that, I shall open with a literary reference. Dreiser, at the end of Sister Carrie, the novel Sister Carrie, places Balzac's book Père Goriot in the hands of the protagonist. Père Goriot is a novel which describes more than others the urban experience, the disruption of all tradition and extremely fast social mobility that is required to keep up with the pace of a metropolitan life. Carrie's transformation from a young country girl into a city dweller is portrayed as the story of a metropolitan making. It is through the acquisition of an identity built on possibilities that Carrie becomes the sister not only to those thousands of American girls that used to leave the countryside for the big cities in search of work and fortune, but also to the metropolitan dweller described by Zimmel. Carrie is Lucien de Rubempré's sister, the protagonist of Balzac's Lost Illusion. She's the sister of Antonia and her friends, as described by Villa Carter. She's the sister of Maggie, the bad girl protagonist of a Stephen Crane novel. Finally, she's the sister of all those unadjusted girls observed and reported by William Thomas in his study on female urban deviants. She's the sister of all those women who find in a city very different from when they have arrived. Is the sister of all these restless young girls and unable to stay in their place, the place that been assigned to them by tradition and that got whipped away by the air of the city. However, Carrie is also Mrs. Dalloway's sister. The aristocratic lady strolling along London streets, and she's Leopold Bloom's sister, the non-hero of James Joyce's Ulysses. So we can say that she's the sister of all those women and men whose lives are strictly mingled with the life of the city, a sister of all those who still in our time, day after day, experience the metropolis as, and Annars says, a place of a serendipity where one casually finds one thing while looking for something else. So we had to go back just, you know, for a few minutes to Zimmel's thought since is the beginning of all the story. Zimmel's short essay, The Metropolis and Mental Life, represents the first analysis and probably still the most significant of the metropolitan experience. Zimmel has been the first to underline the coexistence of risks and opportunities in cities, of danger along with individual achievement, and to view metropolitan life as the local of freedom. All those who, in spite of everything, have loved and love metropolitan life, all those who are strong supporters of individual freedom and of a collective life that transforms itself into a public discourse, hold within them and within their works the speculation of Zimmel's essay. The entire collection of Zimmel's works implies metropolitan life. It implies Berlin. The Berlin where Zimmel was living had gone from 1 million residents in 1877 to 2.5 million in 1900. And such an increase in population was mainly due to the moving of great masses of people into the new metropolis. As a result, the city that comes into being is a city where every single person is a foreigner and without roots, where everyone is at the same time a maker and a witness of the becoming of a metropolis, as well as the transformation of his own human condition. Such a structural and cultural change defines the background and sets the foundation of Zimmel's thought, of his conception of modernity as a condition where every single thing enters into relationship with everything else, where the loss of the unity of the objective spirit coexists with the growing deprivation of the subjective spirit. The experience of the world becomes psychologism, a pure inner experience, and the self, even if fragmented, encounters a hypertrophic development. This is what is described in this essay on the metropolis, and what Rilke described as well. Yes, I am learning to see. I don't know why it is, but everything enters me more deeply. It doesn't stop where it once used to. I have an interior that I never knew of. I am in Paris. This is Rilke in the first pages of the notebooks of Malte Lauritz Brigge, a novel written between 1899 and 1903. Therefore, at the same time as Zimmel, the metropolis and mental life. Possibilities, unforeseen or marginal chance of life are what generate significance in modernity. In metropolises, you learn not to react to every single thing, you learn to stay indifferent, to become, as Zimmel says, blasé. In order to survive, a metropolitan subject needs to intellectualize suppressing emotion and feelings. Metropolises have always been the core of the monetary economy, and such an economy entails and generates the annulment of individuality. Money has to do only with what is in common with everything else, and the value of exchange reduces all qualities to quantities. Modernity, monetary economy, market, social differentiation, and intellectualism are all interdependent phenomena and are typically metropolitan. The metropolis has the capability, not only because of its size, of receiving great amount of performances. However, also due to the concentration of such a vast number of individuals, each person is required to specialize. Zimmel emphasized quite sharply that metropolises end up creating a new specialization in response to corresponding new demands. However, new demands also end up being created incessantly, with the result that not only the performances become more and more diverse, but also their demand. For this reason, too, we see an incessant drive towards individualization. The metropolitan individual needs to constantly fall back on his own uniqueness and distinction in order to draw attention towards him. In metropolises, this produces the most bizarre oddities and a typical metropolitan character, the eccentric. According to Simmel, the metropolis is the symbol of a no society, of a known place, where the individual can never fully feel part of it. The metropolis signifies society in absence of society. To society as a known society, as a set of fragments, corresponds a personality that is equally disintegrated and eradicated, the permanent condition of being a foreigner, an outsider. The foreigner is a typical metropolitan figure because great urban concentration attracted the most dissimilar figures, individuals coming from all kinds of places, and because they tolerate more diversity than what might be tolerated by a small community or a small village. It is precisely on account of this infinite diversity, however, of the incertitude and of being a temporary transit residence for the new urban nomads that even metropolitan dwellers end up feeling somehow foreign, never perfectly entrenched. As a result, the metropolitan individual is at the same time eccentric, disenchanted, uprooted, and possibly also because of this, free. Free from the strict social control exerted by small communities, free from ascribed affiliations, free to drift from experience to experience. The representation of such individuality finds an intense echo in many metropolitan novels, and particularly in Joyce's Ulysses. Leopold Bloom is the metropolitan subject by excellence. He perceives everything without focusing on anything. It is the metropolitan way, the way to avoid being run over by the huge humanity converging in big cities. Simmel's metropolitan subject proceeds through rationalization. Bloom proceeds through daydreams and observation that are utterly casual. But the intellect that Simmel refers to is already distracted, jumping from one perception to another, incapable of focusing on anything. The key awareness of the metropolitan person that he describes is merely a necessary control of emotional and sensorial life. It is an awareness that does not return any meaning, neither to him nor to his environment. The rationalization and the intellectualism that Simmel refers to do not produce understanding, neither provide meaning, nor reciprocate unity to a damaged reality. Simmel's blasé is not only bored, but is also unfocused, evasive, bewildered. And if aware of anything, is only of his being quantité négligeable. Such a metropolitan subject is preparing intellectually and psychically to the birth of Leopold Bloom, to the subject whose attention is discontinuous, is preparing for that way of perceiving things that is appropriate to advertising messages. Bloom has inherited such an unfocused way and such a way of perceiving things from Simmel's blasé, from Simmel's metropolitan dweller. In 1921, Robert Park from the Chicago School has written, "Social scientists are indebted to writers of fiction for our more intimate knowledge of a contemporary urban life." Actually, the description of urban life portrayed in great part of modern and contemporary novels enable the viewing of cities as a complex phenomena. The first literary account is to be found in the first modern European poem, Jerusalem Delivered by Torquato Tasso, which is an epic poem illustrating the city. It was written between 1572 and 1577, at the time when the old town of Ferrara was being destroyed to create the first modern city based on the partition between the main road and the housing. And it expresses the desperation caused by such disruption of the city, by the destruction of places to make room to space. There is a very strict link and a mutual making between the development of the city and at first of modern novels, then later of sociology. Great cities embody the arena and the engine for rebuilding and reinventing the social and political world, as well as the individual consciousness. The first description analysis of this new place of life is the one of Manchester, made by Engels in The Condition of the Working Class in England. It is quite odd that this first description analysis is a kind of crossbreed between a sociological reading ante litteram and an almost literary description. The first portrayal of the modern city comes into being as a contamination of jar, as a blurred jar, launching two potential discourses on the city, the analytical sociological one and the descriptive narrative one, which, although developing through their own rhetoric forms and styles, will often end up crossing each other and, in any case, maintaining forever the marks of such a contamination, of that hybrid origin. As underlined by Stephen Johnson, what Engels observes and describes is primarily the combination of order and chaos visible in big cities. How can these two aspects coexist? What keeps together and makes function this self-organized system that is in fact the city? These were the questions that Engels tried to answer, and these are the same questions and the same problems that from their own all those who have dealt with the city have ended up being confronted with. The description of how individuals live, love, dream, fight, and die in the seeming chaos of a metropolis, which is at the same time a perfectly integrated mechanism, not only produced the plots and the schemes of the new metropolitan novel, but marks its shapes, technique, and language. Engels' bewilderment in Manchester, Johnson writes, assumes a key role even in works of fiction, such as the 19th century urban epics of Dickens and Flaubert, and of more innovative works such as Mrs. Dalloway and Nadia. With Dickens and Balzac's novels, the city breaks into literature. It breaks in as a chaos made intelligible at the very time when it is described. If it is Engels who outlines the basis of the description observation of the urban phenomenon, it is only through the works of fiction that the intelligibility of such a phenomenon becomes clear. It is the modern novel, in fact, that for the first time shows the city as a network, as a system of constant interferences. This will influence the sociological analysis to follow, which will always be marked by the point of view and by the prose of the novelists. It is novels and again novels that surround the sociology of cities and metropolises from side to side, which anticipate theories and analysis, which strain hypotheses and interpretation. The dialogue between metropolitan novels and cultural sociological perspective on cities has been particularly intense in the Chicago School, and this case represents an example of an extremely fertile encounter of two different discourses on the world. What occurs around the Chicago School reveals the link between a city and literature, showing as well how the metropolis produces, among its own cultural objects, also a literature of its own that cannot be ignored by those who study urban context, especially if interested in a cultural analysis and approach. The literature of the city is itself a piece of the city. The Chicago School of Sociology and the Chicago literature both represent an effect of the same urban vortex. They are at the same time product and producer. Through their description and analysis, sociologists and writers contribute in creating those metropolitan characters and behaviors later adopted and interpreted by the Chicago city dwellers who see themselves in the portrait models. Through the affirmation of big cities, novels begin to describe encounters and brushing occurring between strangers in big cities. Novels begin to describe encounters and brushing occurring between strangers. In big cities, people meet accidentally. Adventure is experienced daily in the city because everything is unpredictable, and because day-to-day life is entangled with never-ending emotion and urges. This is the universal element cited by sociology and literature alike. From a sociological perspective, John Jacobs theorizes and demonstrated what metropolitan novels have portrayed: that metropolitan life and the forms and activities characterizing different neighborhoods derive from all the various things that take place on the sidewalks. In particular, the people she describes are witness of a metropolitan experience and the protagonist of a metropolitan novel. Her work testifies a deep contiguity between a certain kind of sociology and literature, in particular the modernist one. The city grows and changes, according to Jacobs, because of those infinite casual interactions that take place in the street. The theater, that constant performance occurring on the sidewalks, is already in itself a novel. According to Jen Jacobs, local interaction molded the city as a self-organizing superorganism, just like the plots and the inner schemes of the first metropolitan novels that set off from casual encounters. For Jacobs, the casual encounters occurring between strangers in public places bring into being the life and the changes of big cities. Interaction between strangers produces their effect on the city as a whole rather than on single individuals. The life of the city is, in literature and such sociological perspective, epitomized as the predicatability thank you, of unpredictable, as the waiting for the unforeseen. The dependence of everyone from each other entails an increase of the variables at stake, holding endless combination. And it is this endless possibility of a combination that symbolizes the metropolitan life and the scheme of a metropolitan novel. It is no chance, Moretti says, that the making of the metropolis, the metropolitan experience, has to do unquestionably with the development of a specific literary rhetoric the suspense novels. The suspense is a cipher of the metropolitan novel. Even the stream of consciousness, the epiphany shared by Mrs. Dalloway and Leopold Bloom, is a totally inner kind of suspense that drags us into this accidental unveiling of common sense. But what is there of metropolitan, of urban-like, into all this? There is that the sudden grasping of bits of oneself happens at the crowded crossing of many streets, right in the middle of a crowd, through words accidentally overheard in a bar, in a street, in the presentation a face, by merit of an advertising billboard, and to the fact that only in a big city one is always among strangers. The metropolitan individual must therefore take care not only grab hold of chances that the metropolitan happening constantly hands him, but also of this unexpected and unpredicted revelation of the self that will never recur again in the same form and with the same intensity, simply because the metropolitan space changes continuously and because the combinations that produce it are infinite. A kind of osmosis occurs between the metropolitan experience, the sociological reading of the metropolis, and the narrating form. What gets converted in the rhetoric forms of the novel or in sociological knowledge then gets converted in behaviors, mental categories, aptitude in social reality. The subject analyzed by Simmel or described by Balzac, Rilke, Joyce, or in our time by Don DeLillo is later affected and influenced by the studies and by the novel shaped on it. All of this happens because the metropolis produces a culture of its own that at the same time replicates and transforms such an experience. Now, if we look at Calvino's Invisible Cities, which are 15 descriptions divided in 11 sets of five cities each, and it's important, I mean, this mathematical division. So if we look at Invisible City, we'll find in a superb literary language a social theory of cities based on the same attention to human interaction as we have analyzed until now. Calvino himself asserts how this book is not about a real cities, but about modern cities. Calvino's greatest concern is to discover the secret motives that have drawn and continue to draw people to live in the cities beyond all crises. Sociologists and novelists have almost always tried to answer two questions. How can a city be described? What is a city made of? Calvino, in addressing these issues, writes, I need to make some quotation from Calvino, Invisible Cities, because they are really necessary for the understanding. So this is Calvino, it's not me, but you will recognize. There are two ways of describing the city of Dorothea. You can say that four aluminum towers rise from its walls, flanking seven gates, with spring-operated drawbridges that span the moat whose water feeds four green canals which cross the city, dividing it into nine quarters, each with 300 houses and 700 chimneys. This description, almost morphological, is a way of talking about a city by dividing it into pieces, listing the existing activities. Or, as Calvino carries on writing, many people were hurrying along the streets toward the market. The women had fine teeth and looked the youth straight in the eye. Three soldiers on a platform played the trumpet. This is instead the description of the urban experience. And this description looks very much like to Jan Jacob's description of life on Hudson Street. Different figures and different function and performance are described by Jacobs just as done by Calvino. We don't know if Calvino has read Jan Jacobs, and that is not important, but they share the same notion of city life. The two ways of recounting the city indicated by Calvino are not in opposition, but can and must coexist. The city of senses is contained in the geometrical city, and vice versa. And the morphological description can contain the unfolding of the pulsing life. When thinking of the city, we bring back to mind its topographic image, and at the same time, its smells, colors, sounds. Writing about it must take into account this dual essence. Calvino concentrated his attention on intangible elements such as memory, desire, fears, exchanges, names, signs. All cities are made up by all of these things, and they differ from each other through the varied combination of such elements. Calvino, through these elements, provides multiple information for understanding the nature of one and all cities as well as of. Every description of the city recalls desires because the city is itself a desire, a desiring machine that never succeeds pleasing all desires. And that very desire that attracts toward the city often ends up in frustration. Calvino, when you are in the heart of Anastasia, one morning you desire to waken all at once and surround you. Since it enjoys everything you do not enjoy, you can do nothing but inhabit this desire and be content. This notion that Calvino has the city as a producer of desires is an altogether modern notion that began with the capitalistic metropolis and is to be found already in Nazim, Balzac, and Flaubert. The desiring subject is, in brief, the new human type generated by the capitalistic metropolis, which he has remained in tune with since then. The elusiveness of the essence of the city is probably the true theme of the 18 dialogue between Marco Polo and Kublai Khan. And the dialogical format encourages this undeterminacy. Calvino, in the dialogues between Khan and Polo, makes a number of remarks on the epistemology of social science. These remarks represent in their conversation items about the status and the meaning of the description of the cities that Polo is presenting to Khan. Their methodological agreement and disagreement serve dramatic purposes as well as scientific ones, but certainly are remarks on problems of method that continue to worry social scientists. Khan and Polo recognize the empirical basis of knowledge. They discuss the connection between the specific case and the general rule, between the description of a specific city and some general laws how cities are organized and function. This too is a standard and a perennial problem of a social science method. Khan proposes a model city that contains everything corresponding to the norm, from which all possible cities can be deduced. According to Kahn, it needs only to foresee the exception to the norm and calculate the most probable combinations. To this model city, Polo opposes his own model, a city made only of exceptions, incongruities, and contradictions. Cities that are logically deducible do not exist, says Marco Polo. I cannot force my operation beyond a certain limit. I would achieve cities too probably to be real. This because Calvino, as Jacobs, believes that cities are a result of multiple unforeseen interactions rather than a result from a rational plan. Jacobs and Calvino share the same notion of the city as a kind of a commedia dell'arte, where, even if an informal plot exists, roles have been assigned, each character improvises and creates something new and unexpected. This is what, according to Jacobs, happens in big cities, and this is what happens in the city of Melania. Howard Baker, sociologist, defined Calvino an urban sociologist. I agree with Baker, and I think that Calvino has used in writing this book a kind of sick description in the same way as Clifford Geertz. Through Invisible City, we learn to look at cities beyond the perceptible spatial order. The invisible cities described by Calvino are the possible cities, those that could be or could have been. They are unfinished spaces, places for constant potential options. For instance, in the center of Fedora stands a metal building with a crystal globe in every room. Looking into each globe, you see a blue city, the model of a different Fedora. These are the forms that the city could have taken if, for one reason or another, it had not become what we see today. To the reading of Calvino, we receive some important clues in order to understand the city. We can extract generalization about urban life from each city described by him. First, the map of a city does not say much or say nothing at all about it. Calvino knows, like a reader, that cars and maps are to the essence of the world, like the anatomy of a dead body is to the living substance of a heart. Cities are therefore invisible because they cannot be constrained into strict categories or classification. They shan't be looked at with purely classifying aims and become invisible. Just like Deleuze, Calvino refuses the notion of a city as an information board, as a diagram where the existing has already blocked all the varieties of the future. Calvino, like Jacobs, refuses a city where abstract geographical schemes establish social contents and come before the needs of life. Second, cities can be understood as a network of relationships. In the city of Ercilia, relationships are represented by strings running between places. Quote, when the strings become so numerous that you can no longer pass among them, the inhabitants leave, the houses are dismantled, only the string and their supports remain. Third, it is the social practices, dreams, projects, utopias, memories, and stories that shape the city. Calvino described the city as if he had read Jean Jacobs through the life and interaction that intertwine it. And it is to the street that the author directs our looks. The urban space, to Calvino's point of view, is characterized by flows of people, money, goods, and stories, by temporal flows.
And this is where the modernity and the importance of Calvino stands, in privileging the temporal dimension over the spatial one. For Calvino, the city is mainly a temporal flow, a flowing of time rather than space. I would like to finish off with a quotation from Italo Calvino, which in some way links to John Jacob's analysis. In the introduction to Italian edition, Calvino writes, "I have written a last love poem to cities at a time when it becomes more and more difficult to live in them. Invisible cities are a dream that originates in the heart of unlivable cities." Many years after its publication, even John Jacob's book appears to us as a poem of love and hope on the metropolis, and places itself within a tradition of a celebration of a metropolitan life existing among the most significant novelists and intellectuals who have given voice to modern culture. A tradition that is still lively to this day and is in opposition to the demonization of the metropolis. And even though for a warning on its crisis, it continues to find more than one reason to love the city. It is also true that metropolises, the great urban center, remain the only places for elaborating the remedies to these very ills. The only places where the risk can transform itself daily into individual and collective opportunities, because of its always being, and in any case, a great social lab, and the quintessential place of experimentation and contamination. At the close of his book, Calvino invites us to seek and learn to recognize who and what in the midst of the inferno are not inferno, then make them endure, give them space. And it was evening time.
Wonderful.
Cutting.
Before I take some questions, I'd like to recount just a memory that you spur me of Calvino. I once took him to a nightclub in New York called Sounds of Brazil. And it's a deafening nightclub with wonderful food. When we got back quite late at night, and his wife asked him, "Where have you been?" And his answer to her was, "I was where this music was." for him, there was no place. It was just where this temporal experience of music was, in any event. Can I invite questions, comments? Do you buy the notion that a city is temporal rather than spatial? We shouldn't accept this without some contestation. Question? Comment? Yes. You've got a microphone. Great.
Most of Calvino's works are not about the city at all, like the Il Barone Rampante or the Visconte di Mezzato. Why did he come to write about cities at the end of his life?
Come quasi tutti gli scritti di Calvino non sono sulla città, tipo il Barone Rampante, come mai alla fine ha scritto così tanto intensamente sulla città?
Uh-huh. In the Italian introduction, Calvino explains how this idea came in his mind. He used to work collecting in a different blocks, any suggestion that came in his mind. And suddenly he realized that he had a lot of material about, cities. And I know also that he has been inspired by a painter. He's an Italian painter, he's not so well known, but he painted some not real cities. And Calvino saw those painting, and he was very impressed. And plus, in this introduction, Calvino says that since that really his concern was to understand why people still won't live in the cities, alive in the cities. And that is why I say that this is a poem, a love poem to the city. The painter, the Italian painter is called Mattioli, but there is a funny story that Calvino was inspired by this, was one of the inspiration, of course, was not the only one. Then the Invisible City came out, and just this year, Latin American painter has painted, has illustrated in with the technique of the gouache, all the invisible cities. And to me, it's very interesting that is, you know, from painting to writing it and again to painting. Actually, I mean, this book is a really, I mean, is a visible book on invisible cities.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah.
Che generalizza la città particolari e se tu
il
rapporto tra vino invece generalizza il particolare e lo specifico.
Actually this is just what Calvino does. I mean, Calvino give us portraits of specific cities, even if not real, but they are described with many, many details, so they are very specific. But if you go through all these cities, you can, you know, find a generalization. For example, when he writes about Zaira, which is the city of the memory, is it describing how the memory is kept in Zaira? But then you have the clue, you know, for understanding cities, that, for example, cities are made of memory. Has the other one that I quoted, the city of Fedora, with this, you know, blue crystal globe, which contains all the future. And then it comes in your mind that every city has to deal with the problem with the future. So I think that this is a wonderful way of, by Calvino, to go up and down from particular to general. I mean, his description a particular, but he offers to us, you know, cue for generalizations. And for me, I think that no generalization, in any case, can be made if you are not rich of particular things.
Yes.
I have two questions for you. The first one is Calvino framing the sensations of the city.
Slowly.
Is Calvino framing the sensations of the city as a temporality experience? And the second one.
Right, let's do one at a time. So, still framing.
Sí.
Sono
And another one is related to the first one. How Calvino established the relationship between time and subjectivity?
But the second,
very simple questions.
They are very interesting.
You are at the LSE.
But for the first question, you said
the framing.
There has been a large debate on your first question. If he's talking about cities out of the time and something. But Calvino writes that he's dealing with modern city. So I think it's not easy to answer because you can't imagine, in certain point you can imagine a really modern city, especially in the end of the book. In the end of the book, there are, many clues that he's talking about a city as Los Angeles, for example. Other is more difficult, but since his concern, what he gives us is to think about the problems in how can we live in the core, he says, of unlivable cities, then I think that he's speaking about our time cities. The second, really, I don't know. I don't have any idea.
Well, you remind me of something about this. Sorry to intervene on this, but he once made a remark about memory that maybe bears on this. I found that notion of city of memory, of course, very suggestive and so on, but very elusive, what he meant by it. And he said, well, you could even think of memory as being the corpse inside a casket. Or you could think of memory being the casket which contains the corpse. Mm-hmm. I think I understand I don't know if I exactly understand, but I think I understand what the distinction is. That usually when we think about time in a city, we think about monuments, right, which are the caskets, right? And for him, these are all rotting. Instead, they're rotting corpses. That our sense of time is always degrading. And that's why these physical forms, rather than attesting to something, our memory is never something where we recall something that's static like an image, but that our experience of time is always this notion of this rotting corpse. And I think that informs this whole, that's the kind of gravamen, that's the kind of depth of this whole notion of creating a city in the past. It's already something which is removed. It's why Marco Polo and the Khan, rather than Los Angeles, it's removed from us the experience we have of time, which is of its not building something, but of decay. That's very important for them. Sorry.
No, this is. I think that this is why when in one of the dialogue, Khan asks Polo, you have talked with me about so many cities, but you never mentioned Venice. Why? Uh-huh. And Polo answers, Khan, which city do you think that I was talking about? I was talking always about Venice. That is very important for this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This kind of
memory, which is something that is not dead, that makes you...
Right, which is not rotting.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Makes you image. And it's also interesting that this metaphor of memory and the city soul stratification has a stratification of city is a metaphor which records. For example, I quoted Torquato Tasso, the Jerusalem Deliverage. I don't know how familiar you are with Tasso. Anyway, Torquato Tasso get mad and he died as a madman.
Insane.
Yeah. And, you know, and there are good elements to think that part of his illness was the cause, was this disruption of the city in which he was living, of Ferrara. And in one poem, a little poem, Torquato Tasso wrote, "The city is a soul." So just, you know, this disruption of the city is a disruption of the soul. And then we have again, you know, Freud with, uses again the metaphor of the cities as
layers
of memory. And Calvino again, you know, with the cities made by memories. I think that is a recurring metaphor.
Yeah.
But you have, there are English here, so you...
Yeah, no,
chat.
No, I understand. Thank you for this very interesting question. I think that when Calvino meant modern city, he was he wanted to say that he wanted to indicate the problems of modern city. For example, the problem of the future of the city is a real problem. I mean, which will be the future of London? Which will be the future of Paris, or New York, or Los Angeles, of Hong Kong, and so on? Modern city seems more and more to be planned by an abstract scheme. We're not considering the needs of people while to live in it. And again, Calvino is telling us about that, you know, that when he speaks about the sounds, the smells, and the network of the people who are moving from, who are continuing a dialogue and so on, what is telling us? He's telling us, you know, about the life of the people. And these are the problems. Even in of our modern city. So I think that his indication is a methodological one, and that is what is why we can use this perspective. And again, I think that this book is not only a love poem toward the city, but is also a kind of protest against urban studies or urban description, which deduce, you know, the city from the map in a continuity with a tradition which starts, let's say, with the Baroque city, where the city becomes, you know, the map of itself. The map is more important than the city. And if you look, I just, you know, sign down a definition by the Encyclopedia of Latin, where the definition of the city is an ensemble of houses posed along the streets closed by walls. I think that against this kind, you know, of observation, this kind of definition, that invisible cities have been written.
So, well, I want to thank you very much for a wonderful talk, and I hope this will be the first of many. Thank you very much.